Warning, the first portion of the following podcast contains no adult language, almost no sexual imagery, and nothing to make you say, man, that's a dirty play. You've been warned that you really don't need to skip this one. Well met, and welcome to episode 150, the Bill Shakespeare Project podcast for April the 16th, 2017. For our blog and previous podcast episodes, check us out at thebillshakespeareproject.com. Greetings, this is Bill Walthall, and in this podcast we continue our discussion of Coriolanus, with a look at the body stuff in the play, and there's almost none, plus discussions of homoeroticism, again, and homosociality in the play. Plus, we'll get a little mother-loving in. So be my mother lover, they bless us both with the gift of life. She brought you in this world, so well, let's start with the body, get it out of the way. Notice, there's no warning. That's because there's not a whole lot of body in Coriolanus. Eric Partridge, the author of The Great Shakespeare's Body, sums it up. Possesses a few more particularities than Macbeth, yet in its general effect, even less objectionable. And remember, he called Macbeth the purest of the tragedies. So as a cop on the body beat, I'm almost tempted to wave you off and say, move along, nothing to see here. Almost. But that would be shirking my duty. He said duty. Anyway, here we go. In Act 4, Scene 2, when Volumnia and Virgilia accost the plebeians' tribunes, the mother says that she wishes that the tribunes were an army before Martius, his good sword in his hand. And Virgilia follows up by saying that Martius would kill them all and their children, making an end of their posterity. Volumnia goes one further, saying, bastards and all. Here she implies adulterous sex on the part of the tribunes. Like I said, not very body. Later, when the Romans learn of Martius's defection to the Volscians, Cominius warns the tribunes that they have helped to ravish your own daughters and to see your wives dishonored to your noses. And here we get rape imagery. And that's pretty much it. So there's not much, unless you use some homoerotic content to fill in the gaps, and I'm guessing that accounts for Partridge's particularities. Homoeroticism, you say?
Oh my.
Tell me more. Not quite yet. I'm nothing if not a tease. So first, a digression. Now, over the last couple of months, I've taken a master's level course in Shakespeare, in which I wrote a lengthy paper on cuckoldry and the male anxiety caused by the fear of it in both Much Ado About Nothing and Othello. It turned out pretty well, but more importantly, though, it introduced me to a sociological concept called homosociality. Basically, it's same-sex relationships, loving, caring, mentoring, supportive, but not romantic or erotic in nature. The link I drew in the paper was between the fear of female sexuality and how the men's previous homosocial bond through the military made it easier for them to accuse the females of adultery. Maybe this whole homosociality thing has been on my mind, but I see it in Coriolanus as well. Interestingly, there are sociological bonds not just between members of a group, let's say an army, but also between ranks within a group, officers or leaders. In Coriolanus, however, we find a weird variation of this, the affinity between the leaders, Martius and Aufidius, despite the fact that they come from two separate armies. When, in the opening scene of the play, Martius learns that the Volscians are on the military move, he responds, they have a leader, Tullus Aufidius, that will put you to it. I sin in envying his nobility, and were I anything but what I am, I would wish me only he. Now, here the bond is not simply between soldiers, but between leaders of opposing armies. Martius admits to the envy and even pride. He is a lion that I am proud to hunt. This comparison is much better than the one he has for the non-military members of his own nation, the common cry or pack of curs. When he reveals himself to Aufidius, Martius states, but if so be thou darest not this, and that to prove more fortunes thou art tired, then in a word, I also am longer to live most weary, and present my throat to thee and to thine ancient malice, which not to cut would show thee but a fool, since I have ever followed thee with hate, drawn tons of blood out of thy country's breast, and cannot live but to thy shame, unless it be to do thee service. Now, that's a wonderfully complex sentence. Yes, that's a 10-line sentence. Marcius equates himself with the man he once said he hated. If Aufidius is too tired to fight in another battle, then Marcius is too tired to live, and presents his throat for Aufidius to cut. If Aufidius fails to cut it, the inaction will show the Volscian a fool and will shame him, the only cure for which is to allow Marcius to fight for him. And when Aufidius accepts him, giving him half of his own Volscian army, it is with this statement of brotherhood: 1,000 welcomes, and more a friend than e'er an enemy. The foes, opposites, are now brought together, and their homosocial bond is strengthened. Of course, when Aufidius later feels more like his follower, not a partner, it is a breaking of the homosocial bond, not between members of the same army, but of the same rank, a tearing apart that leads to Aufidius plotting Coriolanus's death. After the death, however, Aufidius's rage is gone, and he is struck with sorrow, a mourning for his lost brother. Now, with that homosociality out of the way, what about that homoeroticism? Last month I discussed what I thought was the ham-handed attempt at displaying that homoeroticism in the 1983 BBC production. However, you knew there was going to be a however. That first speech by Aufidius, after Marcius asks to join his army, well, let's just say this is probably where the genesis of Moschinsky's homoerotic angle comes from. O Marcius, Marcius, each word thou hast spoke hath weeded from my heart a root of ancient envy. If Jupiter should from yond cloud speak divine things and say 'tis true, I'd not believe them more than thee, all noble Marcius. Let me twine my arms about that body, where against my grained ash 100 times hath broke and scarred the moon with splinters. Here I clip the anvil of my sword and do contest as hotly and as nobly with thy love as ever in ambitious strength I did contend against thy valor. Know thou first, I loved the maid I married. Never man sighed truer breath, but that I see thee here, thou noble thing, more dances my rapt heart than when I first my witted mistress saw bestride my threshold. Why, thou Mars, I tell thee, we have a power on foot, and I had a purpose once more to hew thy target from thy brawn or lose my arm for it. Thou hast beat me out 12 several times, and I have nightly since dreamt of encounters twixt thyself and me. We have been down together in my sleep, unbuckling helms, fisting each other's throat, and waked half dead with nothing. So, let's get this straight. If God, from heaven above, were to tell me something was true, I'd believe him no more than I'd believe you. Let me wrap my arms around that body that my pronged wooden spear, grained ash, has broken against so that it sent splinters to the moon. Here I grab your chest, the anvil of my sword, which has bent the weapon, and struggle as hotly and nobly with your love as ever I did with strength struggle against your bravery. Know first, though, I loved the woman I married. But when I see you, you noble thing, my heart dances more than when I first saw my wife in my doorway. You god of war, I tell you that we have an army in the field, and I had purpose to chop off your head or lose my arm trying. You have beaten me 12 times in battle, and since then I have dreamt every night of new encounters between you and me. In my sleep, we've knocked each other down, unbuckled our helmets, grabbing each other's throats with our fists, and then I wake half dead. Alrighty then. Maybe I gave that BBC production too hard a time. No pun intended. Well, Maybe. So we have a little bit of both homosociality and homoeroticism in Coriolanus. We see some military-based quasi-male bonding within the armies and across armies within the same rank between Martius and Aufidius. But there's nothing erotic about those exchanges and those bonds. We also see some pretty highly charged homoerotic imagery in that Aufidius speech responding to Martius's defection. But there didn't seem to be too great a connection. Notice I said didn't. But looking back at an earlier exchange between Martius and Cominius, there is a link to that later dialogue between Martius and Aufidius. In Act 1, Scene 6, Martius tells Cominius, who is pleased to find the general alive, "Oh, let me clip you in arms as sound as when I wooed, in heart as merry as when our nuptial day was done and tapers burnt to bedward." The language is almost identical to that from the later exchange which I just read a moment ago. The same use of the word clip to wrap around. The same somewhat denigrated recollection of their own wedding nights. So why parrot this exact language if there isn't a connection? Is this Coriolanus' own homoeroticism? Need some teaching resources? Need to adorn your teaching materials with some Shakespearean goodies? Well, check out the Bill Shakespeare Project page on the teacherspayteachers.com site. We've got materials on Romeo and Juliet, Julius Caesar, King Lear, Othello, Troilus and Cressida, and Titus Andronicus, with more on the way all the time. Plus, you can find the handout version of the periodic table of Shakespeare. Now, some are free, some are for purchase, but all quality items. And for those of you who were asking for bigger poster-sized versions of that periodic table, you can order those from our Redbubble page. Links to both pages can be found in the navigation of this here website. Okay, during the last podcast, I mentioned that the Fiennes film of Coriolanus seemed to accentuate a certain Oedipal reading in the production, especially in a scene following Martius's return from Coriolis. Volumnia lovingly bandages his wounds in the bathroom, sharing a quiet, almost whispered conversation. When his wife Virgilia walks in on them, they turn and look at her, and she wordlessly leaves the room, closing the door for their privacy. Of course, I wouldn't exactly call that Oedipal, but there's something there. In the play's first scene, as the first and second citizen discuss the relative merits and sins, mostly sins, of Martius, the first citizen states of Martius's motivation for heroism. Though soft-conscienced men can be content to say it was for his country, he did it to please his mother and to be partly proud. They had originally criticized his pride, but now mother-pleasing trumps even that. And to have this stated so early in the play, before there is any real verbal defense of him, helps to set this conception and to stick it in our heads as an audience. In the third scene of the play, as Volumnia talks to Virgilia, the mother does make an interesting husband-son verbal link. "If my son were my husband, I should freelier rejoice in that absence of him being in battle, wherein he won honor, than in the embracements of his bed, where he would show most love." Husband, bed, embracements, love. Maybe I was wrong on that whole no Oedipal thing. There is no father. And there is no brother, at least not now. Volumnia talks of a time when Martius was tender-bodied and the only son of her womb. Martius, if nothing else, is her firstborn son. But you do get the feeling that he is the only son. As she says, "Had I a dozen sons, each in my love alike, and none less dear than thine and my good Martius, I had rather had 11 die nobly for their country than one voluptuously surfeit out of action." With a mother like that, can you blame a boy for wanting to please his mom? Yet, it might also be a bit embarrassing. When pleading with Cominius to stop praising him, Martius admits, "My mother, who has a character to extol her blood when she does praise me, grieves me." Martius has been embarrassed by his mother's public praise. So it's no surprise that when they re-enter Rome, Cominius points out first Volumnia to Martius. And his action? The conquering hero kneels before his mother. As we've noted before, Martius speaks first to her and then to his wife, whom he calls Silence, then chides Virgilia for her tears, saying that those are what the widows and mothers in Coriolis have. Obviously, Martius is not a fan of the typical female. Nor does he have much use for children. When Brutus informs Martius that he has lost the support of the people, Martius responds, "Have I had children's voices?" dismissing the citizens, equating them with children. After retreating from the Senate after the public accusation, Martius, still railing against the citizenry, immediately invokes his mother. "I muse my mother, does not approve me further," and in an attempt to show her his mettle, he tells her, "I play the man I am." Disdainful of women and children, this concept of manhood is obviously important to him. Note, later in the scene, for those Oedipal fans out there, she does tell him, "I am in this your wife, your son, these senators, the nobles." You know, just saying. Anyway, so he's disdainful of all women save his mother, who is able to convince him to go to the citizens. And when that plea to the people doesn't work and he's been banished, the first person he comforts is not his son, nor his wife, but you guessed it, his mother. "Nay, mother, where is your ancient courage?" After he leaves, she is left desperate, angry, and out for blood. "Anger's my meat. I sup upon myself." When Martius joins with the Volscians, his wife and mother and son attempt to convince him to show mercy on Rome. Again, it is he who kneels to Volumnia. And ultimately, he bows to her request. "Oh, mother, mother, what have you done?" Just like any mother-pleasing boy would. If you've enjoyed this podcast, but you haven't been following along with our daily blog entry since our last regular podcast, you've missed out on subjects including Volumnia, or is that Vituria? Thanks, and fun with stats. Oh, what a mother. Sorry, no Coriolanus today. Homosociality. And what do we make of this? Coriolanus, body. The title has anus in it. When homosociality meets homoeroticism. Write me a letter. This old man. Silencio, por favor. So, if you'd like more in-depth discussions or just want a daily fix, check out the blog entries at thebillshakespeareproject.com or become a fan of our Facebook page and our Twitter feed. Remember that those social media outlets are more for Shakespeare news and notes than for discussions of our current play under study. Also, if you have any question or comment about this or any other Bill Shakespeare Project podcast or blog entry, you can always lob me an email at bill@thebillshakespeareproject.com. And join us again for our next podcast when we wrap up Coriolanus. We hope to see you then. Been listening to the Bill Shakespeare Project podcast for April the 16th, 2017. For our blog and previous podcast episodes, check us out at thebillshakespeareproject.com, and we shall see thee anon.